Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we kick off National Poetry Month with former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins, who was interviewed by Irish Ambassador to the U.S. Daniel Mulhall. This conversation took place December 8th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, I'm Kevin Byrne. I'm Consul General here at the Irish Consulate in Chicago. We're really delighted to be partnering with the American Writers Museum on this event, particularly as literature and poetry has helped so many of us both escape and reflect upon the difficult times that we're all living through. It's my true honor to introduce the main speaker, Billy Collins. He is an author of 12 collections of poetry, including The Rain in Portugal, Aimless Love, Horoscopes for the Dead, The Trouble with Poetry, Nine Horses, Questions About Angels, and The Art of Drowning. He is also the editor of Poetry 180, A Turning Back to Poetry, and Bright Wings, an illustrated anthology of poems about birds. A former distinguished professor at Lehman College of the City University of New York, he has served as the Poet Laureate of the United States from 2001 to 2003, and a New York State poet from 2004 to 2006. In 2016, he was inducted into the American Academy of Letters. Billy will be in conversation with Ambassador Dan Mulhall, who is the current Ambassador of Ireland to the United States, a position he has held since 2017. Prior to coming to the US, Ambassador Mulhall was Ireland's ambassador to the United Kingdom, to Germany, and to Malaysia. A scholar of Irish history, Ambassador Mulhall maintains a keen interest in Irish history and literature. He's the author of A New Day Dawning, A Portrait of Ireland in 1900, and co-editor of The Shaping of Modern Ireland, A Centenary Assessment. For the many fans of poetry who are also on Twitter, he'll be reading one of his favourite Irish poems on Twitter throughout the month of December. I will now hand over to Billy, who will read for us from his newest collection of poems, Whale Day.
Well, great. It's very nice to be here. And thank you, Kevin, for that introduction. I don't want this to be an infomercial, but I do have a new book called Whale Day that just came out in September and was sort of a highlight of these sort of inactive stretches of time. So I'm going to read a few poems from Whale Day and then jump into another collection. But I'd start I'd start with this poem that it might strain your credulity, starting with the title. And the title is Walking My 75-Year-Old Dog. She's painfully slow, so I often have to stop and wait while she examines some roadside weeds as if she were reading the biography of a famous dog. And she's not a pretty sight anymore, dragging one of her hind legs, her coat too matted to brush or comb, and a snout white as a marshmallow. We usually walk down a disused road that runs along the edge of a lake whose surface trembles in a high wind and is slow to ice over as the months grow cold. We don't walk very far before she sits down on her worn haunches and looks up at me with her rheumy eyes. Then it's time to carry her back to the car. Just thinking about the honesty in her eyes, I realize I should tell you she's not really 75. She's 14. I guess I was trying to appeal to your sense of the bizarre, the curiosities of the sideshow. I mean, who really cares about another person's dog? Everything else I've said is true, except the part about her being 14. I mean, she's old, but not that old. And it's not polite to divulge the true age of a lady. I think what I was doing there, I mean, if you're dealing with any pet, really, I mean, even a goldfish, but especially an ancient dog, the poem can get very moist, that is to say, sentimental. And I think I was trying to balance that with this thoroughly unreliable narrator who switches the age back and forth and finally won't even tell you what age she is. The next poem in Whale Day is called Life Expectancy. And there are many signs of aging, as we know or we learn to know. And this is a rather odd one, life expectancy. On the morning of a birthday that ended in a zero, I was looking out at the garden when it occurred to me that the robin on her worm hunt in the dewy grass had a good chance of outliving me, as did the worm itself, for that matter, if he managed to keep his worm head down. It was not always like this. For decades, I could assume that I would be around longer than the squirrel dashing up a tree or the nightly raccoons in the garbage, longer than the barred owl on a branch, the ibis, the chicken, the horse, longer than the four deer in a clearing, and every creature in the zoo except the elephant and the giant tortoise, whose cages I would hurry past. It was just then in my calculations that the cat padded noiselessly into the room, and it seemed reasonable, given her bright eyes and glossy coat, to picture her at my funeral, dressed in black as usual, which would nicely set off her red collar some of the mourners might pause in their grievings to notice, as she found a place next to a labradoodle in a section of the church reserved for their kind. I think part of that was just wanting to use the word labradoodle before it went out of style. This is a little poem called Sleeping on My Side. I began writing it when I read, I was looking at the collected poems of Elizabeth Bishop, and I saw on facing pages two poems. One was titled Sleeping on the Ceiling, and the other one was called Sleeping Standing Up. And I thought, being fairly conservative poet in a way, I would write a poem that was a little more traditional, and it kind of evolved into a sonnet. It's called Sleeping on My Side. Every night, no matter where I am, when I lie down, I turn my back on half the world. At home, it's the East I ignore, with its theaters and silverware, as I face the adventurous West. But when I'm out on the road in some hotel's room, 213 or 402, I could be pointed anywhere, yet I hardly care, as long as you are there, facing the other way. So we are defended in all degrees, and my left ear is pressing down as if listening for hoofbeats in the ground. So I'm going to turn, I'm going to read a few more poems and keeping track of the time here. And this is a poem from the collection before this new one, and it's called Only Child. We kind of know who we are. Only children to me sounds like an oxymoron. I don't think there should be a plural for only child. And Jeff Dyer has a wonderful piece. He's an only child. And he points out that the only child has a number of features, but one of them is the only child is great at receiving love, but bad at initiating love, because there's been this this torrent of parental love pouring in through the child's childhood. And the other thing he points out is that the only child is very bad at lying. And that's because there's no one there in the childhood to blame. There's no brother or sister. You can't say that was Charlie's fault. He knocked the lamp over. No, it's all you. So here's the poem called excuse me, Only Child. I never wish for a sibling, boy or girl. Center of the universe, I had the back of my parents' car all to myself. I could look out one window, then slide over to the other window without any quibbling over territorial rights. And whenever I played a game on the floor of my bedroom, it was always my turn. Not until my parents entered their 90s did I long for a sister, a nurse I named Mary, who worked in a hospital 5 minutes away from their house and who would drop everything, even a thermometer, whenever I called. Be there in a jiff and on my way were two of her favorite expressions. And now that the parents are dead, I wish I could meet Mary for coffee every now and then at that Italian place with the blue awning, where we would sit and reminisce, even on rainy days. I would gaze into her green eyes and see my parents, my mother looking out of Mary's right eye, and my father staring out of her left, which would remind me of what an odd duck I was as a child, a little prince and a loner who would break away from his gang of friends on a Saturday and find a hedge to hide behind. And I would tell Mary all about that too, and never embarrass her by asking about her non-existence. And maybe we would have another espresso and a pastry, and I would always pay the bill and walk her home. And I thought maybe another one. It's a little poem called Irish Spider. It's only 9 lines long. Irish Spider. It was well worth traveling this far just to sit in a box of sunlight by a window in a cottage with a steaming cup of tea, and to watch an Irish spider waiting at the center of his dewy web, pretending to be just any spider at all, a spider without a nation, but not fooling me for a minute. And there's one little, read this little poem here, and then we can have a chat. This is a poem. I'm in the habit of taking a walk in the morning around the edge of this perimeter of this lake that's just down the street. And I kind of walk and run, and I call it speed walking, although if you saw me, you'd probably have a less romantic word for it. I came back from the walk, and often I just start recording what happened on the walk, which is often next to nothing, which is the way I like to start. And then because of the date and something that happened before the date, it became another kind of poem. And it's called Speed Walking on August 31st, 2013. Nothing much to report this morning, as if anyone were waiting to hear, putting the day on hold, like. Just a few women jogging by, girls with their eyes lowered, and a few men, their awkward hellos. The squirrels don't really count because of their ubiquity. But there was the one brown rabbit, frozen up ahead on the cinder path, immobile as a painting of a brown rabbit. So I stopped and tried to be as still as a pencil drawing of a man, and maybe half a minute passed before he bounced himself into the woods. Was that you, Seamus, coming to pay me a little visit? Who else could it possibly be? I asked with confidence. Not Robert Penn Warren, surely. No, only you, with your eye still bright. So that was my poem that ended up being a poem for Seamus Heaney. I think if I'd written, elegy for Seamus Heaney at the top of a page, I'd end up either doing scribbles or being paralyzed. I let that into the poem, and I think that's the only way I can approach volatile, emotional matter. By taking it at a slant, as Emily Dickinson says. So anyway, I'd love to read more poems later, but I'd love to hear Daniel and get into conversation.
Sure. Well, look, I've been tweeting poetry for the last 5 years. I've never written a line myself, but I know quite a few poets in Ireland and Britain and Germany and in Malaysia, where I've been posted, and also in India when I was there. So I've known poets, and it's really a pleasure to meet you virtually. I hope we can meet in the real world one of these days when life returns to normal. It would be a great pleasure to be able to shake your hand and give you a hug. But anyway, for the moment, we'll have to have to do with the virtual hug. Just a first comment and question, if you like. I mean, the poet Derek Mahon, who died earlier this year, really outstanding Irish poet, the same generation as Seamus Heaney and Michael Longley and those. And Derek Mahon's, he has a poem called "Everything Is Going to Be All Right," which is kind of, it's a very optimistic poem. It's sort of, it talks about sitting in a riot of sunlight and everything's going to be all right. And it's kind of been adopted in Ireland really as the, as a poem for the pandemic because of its, of its optimistic tone and conclusion. It talks about they'll be dying, but don't worry about that, you know, sort of moves on to be more optimistic about the future. The poem was written 30 or 40 years ago. It's not a poem about today at all. But in the poem, he makes the following comment, following a couplet. The poems flow from the hand unbidden, and the hidden source is the watchful heart. Mm-hmm. Is this a theory of poetic inspiration that you recognize, the idea that poems emerge from some kind of mysterious realm beyond the prosaic?
Well, I think I certainly believe in the superiority of poetry to prose. My friend and I have had this debate. She's a novelist, I'm a poet, and I told her as kind of winding up this debate that I said, think of it this way. Poetry is a bird and prose is a potato. And that kind of ended our talk for a while. There's a mysterious, I don't like to over poetry, there's so much mysterious poetry around, unnecessarily mysterioso poetry. I don't like to add to that by talking about the Delphic mythic source of poetry. However, when I start a poem and it starts rolling, like when I suddenly have this idea that at my age, looking around at some of these birds and squirrels, they could be around longer than I. As soon as I had that notion, then it was a matter of just running with that and ringing the changes and then doing what the real work of poetry is, finding an ending, I think. Finding a place where I don't want to say anymore, you don't want to hear anymore. There's a sort of nice agreement about that. So, but there is an odd aspect to it where this stuff comes from. And I guess the real question is, does this come from training, from writing? Derek, I've known Derek not terribly well, but I knew him when he was in the States. Whether Derek, he and I are both poets of many, many decades, whether that comes from a lot of training, a lot of kind of trained to be a kind of opportunistic person, let's write a really optimistic poem. That's very unlike Derek, to go out of character in a way. He's not a terribly, you know, optimistic poet. But he is certainly the poet who's, in my mind and a lot of other minds, has written the best poem about the Holocaust, the disused shed in County Wexford. Yeah. So yeah, there's a little bit of mysterious, but there's a little bit of a lot of work to the poem also, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, my literature teacher in University College Cork back in the 70s, John Montague, was a fine Irish poet as well. You may have come across him. He was born in New York, grew up in County Fermanagh. And he always, if we asked him about a lesser poet, he would always say, he wasn't touched by the muse. I always found this rather amusing. Do you feel the muse has touched you, or do you go along with that kind of notion of poetry?
No, I don't think I've ever been kissed on the forehead or touched with the wand or whatever metaphor you want to like. No, I mean, I started writing poetry because I was very in touch. I was very taken with the romance of the poet, the romantic figure of the poet. This was in high school when one is feeling kind of romantic about oneself. And from that point on, my career in poetry has really been a series of imitations. I'm not getting it from the muse. I'm getting it from other poets. So my, what would you call my voice, my poetic voice, is not something that I had to awaken within me as the result of navel gazing or soul searching. On the contrary, my poetic voice comes from borrowings from various poets and being issued permission slips to explore certain areas. I remember reading a poem by Tom Gunn when I was in high school, and was either called Elvis Presley or it was about Elvis Presley. I didn't know you could write about Elvis Presley in those days. Just like Whitman didn't think you could write about machinery in his poem in the middle of the 19th century called Locomotive in Winter. And he's very aware that he should not be writing about machinery. He should be writing about nature. So so I learned from other poets, and you learn by not just being inspired, you learn by being jealous of them. Professors call this literary influence. It's actually it's actually envy.
You know, the my other literature professor at University College Cork, Sean Lucy, he always talked about his main kind of commanding idea was T.S. Eliot's tradition and the individual talent, the idea that each poet kind of enters the tradition and then kind of gives the tradition a twist and a turn and makes it his own and then moves the tradition onwards. Do you see that? I mean, who are the poets who gave you your permission slips when you were starting out in this journey?
Well, the main poets, I mean, when I was in high school, the beat poets were very popular. So I was, in love with the romance of the poet. I was imitating beat poetry. I was against capitalism, for example. I was a little rebel.
But a lot of us were.
I know. But
nothing to be ashamed of.
Right. The real influence is, if you don't take yourself terribly seriously, you're not going to even think about being a poet. But the real first permission slips were given to me when I started reading poets who were humorous without being silly. And those would be Philip Larkin, certainly, even Patrick Kavanaugh a little bit. The New York poets like Kenneth Koch and Frank O'Hara and James Schuyler, and more contemporary poets, too many to name. My little theory, if I have a minute here, my little theory about humor is that humor had a very strong place in English poetry or poetry in English. Chaucer is funny. Shakespeare wrote comedies. The metaphysical poets delved in wit. 18th century poets delved in satire. That's having fun at the expense of others. And then everything comes to a screeching halt, or this tradition of humor, the thread of humor, when we get to the English Romantic poets. And it seems to me, I imagine Wordsworth and Coleridge, for example, going into a back room somewhere, closing the blinds and making a deal. And the deal is that we're going to eliminate sex and humor from poetry and substitute landscape. Now, this to me is a bad deal, I think, for a lot of people. And humor really didn't recover. Humor was then consigned to this little ghetto of light verse, right? Silly verse. And it didn't recover until around the 1950s with poets like Philip Larkin and the other people I mentioned. But nowadays, humor has a very strong place in poetry, and it's reclaimed its legitimacy as a way not to just entertain people, but to access more serious matter.
Yeah, I mean, reading your poems. I mean, I read them years ago in an anthology of American poetry, and then I read Whale Day and The Rain in Portugal and another collection's name I can't remember. But anyway, what I see in your poems is that they're kind of laid out before us in plain sight. There's none of this kind of hiding in the undergrowth and trying to, duck, bob and weave and avoid being detected. They seem to be sort of, they're mystery. There's always mystery in poetry, but it seems to be sort of set out there for you. And, you you find it as you read the poem, you say, oh, yeah, that's a wonderful way of looking at it. But, I mean, is that deliberate that you've avoided the kind of temptation to go all inaccessible and excessively convoluted in the way you compose your verse?
Yeah. Well, it was a temptation that I felt occasion to fall to it in high school and college. When I first started writing poetry, I knew two things about poetry from the ones I was reading, that poetry was very difficult to understand. But one thing you could understand was that the poet was miserable. And so I started out writing poems that were difficult to understand. And that's very easy. You know, I mean, talk to any drunk. There's a kind of incomprehensibility to the language. And it's easy to use the language as camouflage or a shield. But I really appreciate, Daniel, your sense, the phrase in plain sight. I think I was using the term poets who play visible games, transparent games. You can see what's going on. Like a core example is Charles Simic has a poem called Bestiary for the Fingers of My Right Hand. And he begins with his thumb. It looks like the tooth of a horse or whatever. Well, now the reader is on for the ride. We know he's going to go through the five fingers. You don't know what he's going to say about them, but you're in on the scheme of things. So the poet has turned over a card that allows you to see what's going on, and that to me is very important. I think there's a lot of poetry you just wish they to turn over another card instead of making it a kind of mysterious process that doesn't really involve the reader very much.
Yeah, what I find about your poems is that they are what they're about. I mean, they lay themselves out, and you know, at the end you say, yeah, that's, you know, he's given me something there, something mysterious, but it's done without trickery. It's done with a kind of a plain trowel that has been, you know, it's been laid on. Without any kind of effort to disguise what's being done. Could I ask you, I mean, I during the when the pandemic started and I was hunkering down here at the embassy residence, like most people in the world, I started not just tweeting poetry daily, which I've been doing for 5 years, but I started tweeting readings of poems that I thought were appropriate for the moment. And I found a lot of poems that actually, you know, in some way could relate to the moment that we found ourselves in. But one of the things I discovered when I was tweeting these poems was when I use the hashtag poetry, I often saw that the hashtag poetry was trending on Twitter, which means that like thousands of people around the world were actually putting that hashtag into their tweets. And it made me realize that poetry has some kind of secular, sort of spiritual sort of role somehow, and that people in the pandemic who might never have read a poem in their lives were sort of somehow finding comfort in, you know, poems and poetry. Do you understand that? Do you understand where that sort of notion comes from?
Well, I think I do. I think in these days, as we say, people, poetry is an alternative to the news, for one thing. Yep. The news is bad and worse, and the news is also at times ridiculous and beyond belief. And that, in addition to being locked down, where you're kind of, the news is right there, all the news finds you where you're stuck. Poetry has been in my poetry broadcast I've done since March, every weekday since March, almost 9 months long now. I do a half an hour broadcast in the evening, but we have a worldwide following. Just as an example, there's a woman in Paris who goes to bed, you know, watching this, and there's another woman in Australia that has it with her coffee. So, I did it. My wife encouraged me to do something because she foresaw the process, the prospect of me being at home with nothing to do, not a pleasant experience. And she I took it on to just have some stability to my day. But now, I mean, my listeners think of this as actually a real oasis, an alternative to. To journalism specifically, and I think poetry being an alternative to even prose. So, so I do see the attraction. I wonder why people don't have poetry in their lives on an everyday basis, as you exemplify having your poetry tweet. It's part of your everyday life. Yeah. And I think A lot of people think poetry belongs in the library, in the classroom, on the bookshelf. It doesn't play an integral, ordinary part of their daily life. And yeah. I think more and more people are seeing that, you know, in being in the threat of a terrible sickness, that we need something, and poetry is usually there.
I think it was Seamus Heaney who said that, you know, when he was at college, he dabbled in verses and it became his life. What was it that sort of drove you to adopt the life of the poet as your life's work? I mean, was there a moment or did it happen over a period of time that you sort of found yourself being a poet without actually ever deciding you were one?
Well, that's more like it, yeah. No, there was no one.
I don't know if it's an ambassador by mistake, and I still can't work out why it happened. Where you are. It happened.
I know, it just happens. I think I probably should have given up, but I didn't get a book published until I was over 40. I never had any epiphanic single awakening that I was a poet. I just kind of kept hacking at it until, as I think it was Seamus Heaney who said, I started fooling around with language, and it became my life eventually. And who was it? John Updike said, becoming a writer was like being swallowed by a hobby. So we usually start out by doodling, you know, or fooling around at the piano or something. We start out as it becomes a hobby, and then it moves gradually more to the center of your life. One more thing about that. I was at I gave a reading at my college many years ago, and a dear colleague of mine introduced me, and she said, when I met Billy, he was a professor who happened to be a poet, and now he's become a poet who happens to be a professor. And that is exactly sums up my entire career in teaching and writing. I didn't start out to be, I've never taken a workshop. I got a PhD in English literature, and the poetry kind of emerged emerged and overshadowed my teaching.
At school, we had my secondary school in Waterford in the 1960s. We had a poetry circle in my last couple of years, and a number of people in that circle ended up, you know, becoming poets. I just couldn't. I mean, I could. I always say I've made many deposits in the doggerel bank, but I've never actually managed to write a proper poem. I just, you know, my friends who developed this poets just had that gift, and they were able to do it. And I mean, I can write a, you know, if you ask me to write a 1,000-word essay on Joyce or W.B. Yeats or Sean O'Casey or John Montagu or whatever, I'll do it and I'll produce it and it'll be good. It'll be good enough, you know, but ask me to write a poem, I can't do it. Can I ask you one thing as well? I noticed that, do you purposely avoid long poems? Because I noticed that in the volumes that I have, there are no long poems. Like a lot of poets, I think, almost feel that they have to kind of do this kind of great, you know, four quartets or the, you know, the wasteland kind of, you know, I have a friend, Mihalo Scheele, who's a poet, lives in New York, and he's published a single poem called the Five Quartets, which is a history of the world in verse. Have you ever been tempted in that direction?
No, I'm a sprinter. I can run about 100 yards and that's it. No, I'm very attracted to the sudden of a poem rather than the lengthiness of the novel, say, or even the short story. One potency that the poem has, most of my poems fit on one page. If I get to a second page, it's sort of a spillover. And I've probably written, I could count on my two hands, number of poems that might fill two pages. But I like the suddenness of the poem, the condensation of the poem, and the way the poem kind of searches for an ending before doing too many maneuvers or getting tired of itself.
Yeah, interesting. As the Irish ambassador, I have to ask you about your Irish heritage, and especially the fact that quite a few of your poems, actually, I think there are five poems in Whale Day that have either a setting in Ireland or an Irish theme. And I'm just wondering, you know, about your Irish heritage and what it means to you. And can you explain how it fits into your life as an American poet?
Well, it's interesting because that you said that, because just before, about an hour before this program started tonight, I was looking for poems about Ireland, and I counted five in Whale Day, and I was surprised there were that many, actually. So I've got poems about Ireland in just about every book, and I would like to read a couple more before we end, maybe.
Please, yeah.
I've started going to Ireland very early on in my 20s, and I don't know, it's too long to go into it. I've been there maybe 15 to 20 times. I used to take students over and teach Irish literature, and we'd go to UCD, as it was called then, stay in the dormitories, and I'd start with the Toyne and go to James Joyce somehow. Then I realized this is killing me. And my friend Eamon Grennan would come in, and he would do Ulysses in 3 hours, you know, and I'd have to drag him out of there. And I thought, now it's a lot easier if I just take the thing out to Galway, where there aren't the pressing cultural obligations like the Book of Kells or whatever, and we turn it into a poetry workshop. So for 4 or 5 years, I took students to UCG, as it was called. We stayed in Corrib Village, and we'd have poetry workshops every day, and then we'd go someplace interesting in the afternoon. So I feel I've never really looked up family there. I have a cousin, Bridget, who located us around Skibbereen in western Cork.
Yeah, well, that would be
And my wife and I actually went a little bit out of our way and drove through Skibbereen, had a pint there, and looked and spent some time in the cemeteries. But when I'm in Ireland, I feel tribally at home, like the salmon going upstream or something. I see someone on the street in Dublin that looks like my uncle. You know what I mean? It's a kind of a genetic. It's not like looking up the old grandfather or something, and it's not a family thing. It's more of a tribal thing. But I'm very attached to it, and one of the deprivations of the COVID is not being able to get to Ireland this last summer.
Joined the club. I haven't been back since March, so I'm feeling.
Oh boy!
I'm definitely feeling the sort of separation anxiety at the moment. But anyway, could I ask you one of the poems that intrigues me? The Irish poems in this wonderful collection is "The Wild Barnacle." Where did that idea come from? Because it's an interesting poem, because it sort of develops in a way that's a little bit surprising, and the final bit of it is a very, you know, powerful kind of description of the fate that met the poet Patrick Pearse in 1916 when he was executed for his part in the Easter Rising.
Well, it started with my ignorance that I thought a barnacle was a little a mollusk, a little shelled creature, and in his lovely poem "Lullaby to a Mountain Woman," Patrick Pearse says, "Do not speak, wild barnacle, passing over this mountain." And I thought, what a wild piece of surrealism, these flying barnacles. Do we have time for me to read it?
Please, yes, it'd be great. Yeah,
this is probably the most Irish poem I've written. "The Wild Barnacle," and there's the epigraph from Patrick Pearse. "Do not speak, wild barnacle, passing over this mountain." In a lullaby by the Irish poet Patrick Pearse, a woman of the mountain begins singing her baby to sleep by asking Mary to kiss the baby's mouth and Christ to touch its cheek. Then she gets busy quieting the world around her. All the gray mice must be still, as well as the moths fluttering at the cottage window lit by the child's golden head. Then, amazing to me, one summer night when I first read the poem, she orders a barnacle, of all things, not to speak as it passes over a mountain. To me, a barnacle came with a shell, lived underwater, and stayed put after silently affixing itself to a rock. But here, in the hands of a poet, the small creature is miraculously endowed with the powers of speech and flight. I could see it now on a mountaintop, its black shell shiny with salt water, no more than 2 inches tall, but dancing and riotous with joy and rage, shouting the anthem of the barnacle, loud enough to wake up every baby in Connemara and beyond. But of course, it is the barnacle goose that Pierce had in mind, I later found out, common in the west of Ireland, and quite capable of flight with a honk that could possibly alarm a sleeping baby. For a moment, I had my own wild barnacle, but the barnacle goose is a fact, and so is the fact that Patrick Pierce, known as the schoolmaster, was the one who proclaimed the independence of Ireland from the steps of the General Post Office. And for his troubles, he was stood up with 14 other insurrectionists, save Conley, who was seated due to a recently shattered ankle. Yes, was stood up against the fact of a wall in the courtyard of Kilmainham Jail, Dublin, and executed by a British firing squad in his final May in the terrible, beautiful year of 1916. So any friends of mine who go to Ireland, I say Ireland's a completely self-explanatory country, but you've got to go to Kilmainham Jail, which is a little, as you agree, I think is a little off to the side of the tourist lanes.
You know, I've had, when I was ambassador in London, people were going to Ireland, I would give them a set of places to go. And a number of people came back and said, why didn't you recommend Kilmainham Jail? It's fascinating. And these are people that I thought, well, you wouldn't send them there because it's a bit too kind of close to the bone for an English visitor. But actually, a taxi driver once told me that, you know, a lot of his English visitors wanted to go to Kilmainham Jail. So it is an iconic place. It was run by a friend of mine, Pat Cook, for a long time. So I know the place, you know, pretty well. The other poem I love in this collection is Ireland Floating on the Map of the World. I think that's a wonderful poem. Would you do us the honor of reading that for me, please?
I'd be happy to. Well, it's a little like when we look at cloud shapes, and in Hamlet, we see clouds in the shapes of mountains, and I mean, not mountains, but in animals and camels and whatnot. But also looking at the shapes of maps, we also see that sometimes, like the boot of Italy and that kind of thing. Ireland floating on a map of the world. With Lough Neagh serving as one eye, the body of Ireland looks this morning like nothing less than a rabbit or a hare caught mid-flight in a mighty westward leap. With the ring of Kerry and Berra as the springing hind legs and jutting Mayo as its tender forepaws, the rabbit, or again possibly a hare, is turning its head to look back at the middle part of Britain, around the Lake District, say, or Hadrian's Wall, and thinking nothing but pleasant thoughts about the America where he will eventually land, for he is only famous for his leaping. So I did borrow a little Irish tone in the last line there, right? He's only famous for his leaping.
Leaping, yeah.
But it's about immigration.
I appreciate that. In fact, it's, you know, for me, it's a great poem because it is about that sort of leaping that people leapt in a way. I mean, they didn't leap; they went on leaky boats and suffered greatly when they were traveling. But nonetheless, you know, they did somehow make a leap from Ireland to America, and then, you know, became, you know, thoroughly part of America without ever losing their Irish identity, which is something that I, you know, obviously cherish when I meet people and discover that they may be four or five generations removed from Ireland, but still have a sense of Irish identity, which is meaningful to them. A lot of people want to know, how do you write? I mean, do you sit down every morning and say, okay, I'm going to write a poem now or not? I know that, you know, prose writers do that. They have to do 1,000 words a day or whatever it might be, and they won't leave their room until they've got their quota of words churned out.
Right. Well, that's one of the many reasons I don't write prose. You know, I was not Aubrey Beardsley, but Max Beerbohm said that the most difficult thing about being a poet was figuring out what to do with the remaining 23 and a half hours of the day. I mean, it doesn't take all that long to write a poem. If music is on, it's on. If it's not, it's not. I've never put music on in order to write to it. And I've turned music off because it has words. I can't listen to a song with words if I'm trying to make my own words. But if some jazz is on in the background, as it often is in the house, it's just part of part of the scene. It's and I have a number of poems about jazz, about music, and a poem about Keith Richards. So I've written about music. It's like the weather. It's a source of metaphoric possibility.
This question asks, in your daily poetry broadcasts, you've been reviewing your past works. Have you discovered some of your old poems that you hadn't read in a while? So have you made some discoveries of work that you'd maybe set aside and kind of not gone back to for a long time? Have you made some, you know, rediscoveries of your own work during your poetry podcast series?
Yeah, well, I hate to say this, but it's actually all pretty good.
Yeah,
well, that's my main discovery. I mean, I'm reading poems that I haven't looked at in 25 years or more. In some cases, I don't look at them because I don't read from them at a public reading, and I'm not one to sit around reading my own poems at night. You know, like take me out and shoot me. But I'm reading through books one page at a time. So I'm reading an entire book, which takes a while, and we talk about the poems. But I've only found one or two, you know, poems that would be, you know, maybe slightly embarrassing, only because they're just not very well written. So I'm afraid all I'm discovering is that I was okay. I didn't rush any work into print, for one thing. I was cautioned about that very early. It'll always be around to stink up your book, and you'll regret it forever. So I very early on never let a poem out of the house unless I was line by line by line sure of it. Not just that's a clever poem or that's a nicely emotional poem. I really feel I'm building a poem by lines. I think poets, we are like homo linearium. We are line making creatures, and it's one line at a time. I don't come off as a formal poet. I don't have end rhyme, except occasionally. I'm always writing with the ear, trying to. Also writing with the beat. I'm trying to get the cadence of it. There's a lot of iambic rhythm in there. Why? Because I've studied The Prelude. I've studied Paradise Lost. I've read Shakespeare. I have internalized some kind of iambic rhythm. And if you read for 10,000 hours and read these important works that run by the iambic clock, you too will not have to think about is this a trochee or something like that. You will have a sense of rhythm, just like you have on the dance floor.
So thanks, everybody, for joining us this evening. Thank you, Ambassador Mulhall, and thank you very much, Poet Laureate Billy Collins. You've been wonderful.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, to celebrate Arab American Heritage Month, we'll talk to Sahar Mustafa about her book, The Beauty of Your Face. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.